Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Dr. Stefano Marcuzzi, the Max Weber Fellow at the European University Institute. And today we are discussing his book, Britain and Italy in the Era of the Great War, Defending and Forging Empires, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Dr. Marcuzzi.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
Doctor, why did you write this book?
I would say for a couple of reasons, mainly. One of my interests in terms of research is on coalition warfare. So I'm fascinated by the ways alliances and coalitions function in war. That means under the pressure of unpredictable war events. And if you look, for example, at the Triple Entente, which is an obvious case in point, what is quite striking, if you look at that alliance, we call it an alliance, but in fact, it does have no characteristic of what we tend to consider an alliance today. They had no unified command, like NATO has today, for example. They had no unified diplomacy, no unified economic institutions, like the European Union, for example. Now, they established some of those things as the war progressed, but only very late in the war. But essentially, what they were was an ad hoc fighting group with countries opting in and opting out. And the reason why this is important is that because of this, those countries that joined the Allies tended to create preferential partnerships with one or more countries in that group, depending on the circumstances. You tend to create a better partnership with a country that is either more similar to you or that is less problematic in terms of public opinion and so on, your favorite commercial partner. The reason why this happened can vary. But the fact that these countries operated in that way made me ask myself, how about Italy? Because we had studies about the Anglo-French cooperation, the Anglo-French partnership, about the Anglo-American partnership, about the Anglo-Russian partnership, about the Austro-German partnership, the German-Turkish partnerships, but nothing on Italy. And so I was wondering, did Italy operate the same way? I digged into that question, and I found out that actually, yes, Italy did operate in the very same way, and it picked up Britain as its preferential partner. And then I should probably add a second reason for writing the book, which is, quite frankly, career timeline, because the topic of my PhD research. Essentially, when you do it, you take a PhD, if you want to stay in the academia, the first thing you try to do is to turn that PhD thesis into a book. And so that's another reason.
And what if you could put it in a concise manner, what is the book's thesis?
So, yeah, the thesis flows precisely from the point that I mentioned earlier on. So the importance of the bilateral relationship between Great Britain and Italy to better understand their behavior, both within the Entente and in the war management more broadly. So how that bilateral relationship shaped the war strategies and the war experience of the two countries. And in this regard, I made three conclusions in my book. The first one is that the two countries had opposing war aims, despite initially they thought the opposite. And this is quite interesting, the impact of war developments on shaping the war aims of two belligerent countries. So number one, they had different war aims, and number two, they had different war strategies, and number three, they had different approaches to peacemaking. And the reason why the final outcome of the bilateral relationship, which was conceived as a special one, especially in Italian eyes, turned out to be a very negative thing, can be understood precisely by looking at these three issues that hampered the cooperation between the two countries throughout the war and the peace conference.
How do you approach a rather common Anglophone scholarship? I'm thinking in particular of Alan Taylor, Dennis Mack Smith, and Richard Bosworth, among others, which regards Italy's short period as a great power as some sort of malignant joke.
Yes, that's a traditional, well-established view, and I should probably say maybe that another reason for writing the book now that you raise this issue is that I try to kind of redress the balance a little bit, in the sense that certainly Italy was not so much ridiculed. It was much more ridiculed for its participation and performance in the Second World War, but certainly was evaluated in a negative way, or at least was not considered a fully functional great power, and its performance and contribution to the final victory was generally downplayed. And essentially, as you say, you know, it was considered a country, a Machiavellian actor that has shifted aside according to circumstances, that wanted to be on the winning side, and yet was not even, you know, kind of worthy after all, because it was militarily incompetent. So part of that, I think, is justified in the sense that certainly Italy was not a great power by the standard of the time. It was certainly not like France or Germany, but the prevailing view that the Italian contribution was minimal, I think needs to be redressed, and also the way Italy behaved diplomatically, it was number one not peculiarly Italian, because if you call Italy Machiavellian, then you should say the same thing to, you know, Japan, Bulgaria, Romania. Essentially, all the other countries that joined the war, except the United States, maybe, but all the other countries that joined the war as a consequence of negotiations, essentially, you could call them Machiavellian, and especially, you know, the Romanians, they also shifted their pre-war alliance. So Italy was not unique in that either. But the other reason is that the traditional Anglo-Saxon interpretation didn't take into consideration the fact that Italy was not volunteering to join the Allies. Italy was being invited and was being, in some ways, even blackmailed by the British. So definitely Italy had its appetites. It was an aspiring great power. It exploited the circumstances. It was very pragmatic. But the situation was much more complex than that. And in fact, one might argue that the economic situation of Italy by the winter 1914-1915 made war inevitable, and in fact, you know, the the action, the unilateral action of Great Britain in forcing the hand of Italy, in forcing Italy out of its neutrality, has been traditionally ignored, but played a major role in the final decision to join the Allies.
Insofar as your book has a revisionist aspect in terms of the evaluation of Italian military performance in the Great War, were you influenced at all by John Gooch's book on the subject?
Yes. John is one of the few who was my external examiner, by the way, in Oxford. There is a broader discussion that we should probably make here in the sense that John, just like Richard Bosworth, now Vanda Wilcox, there are a few good scholars that approached the study of Italian matters by assessing the Italian original sources, and that's important because. A lot of other scholars who wrote about Italy in the First World War, or in fact in the Second World War, John Keegan, just to mention one, so first class historians, they did so. They wrote about Italy without having accessed the Italian original sources, without having either the language skills or the capacity to actually go into the archives and look at the original material. Now, that is, of course, a problem because by doing so, of course, John Keegan, for example, made, incredibly wrong assessments. But I should also say that one of the reasons why this happened is actually a responsibility that should be given to the Italian historiography. The lack of engagement on the part of the Italian historiography in the last more than half century, actually, since the end of the Second World War, one may say, played a major role in that. It was a narrow-mindedness on the part of the Italian historiography, which tended to essentially engage with the Italian public only. This was partly, perhaps, a consequence of the parochial attitude that the part of the Italian elite had towards foreign policy, which is sometimes considered as essentially an instrumental tool to be used in domestic politics. Some might say that Italy still has this problem today. And as a consequence of that, intellectually speaking, I think the Italian historiography in the past 50, 60 years simply did not engage enough with international scholarship. And did not produce books that could be, books in English, for example, very, very simply. And because of that, I also try to put myself into the shoes of an English scholar who has to write about Italy, finds Italy as, a topic in, First or Second World War matters. And of course, you're an English native speaker. First of all, you have a lot of material in English already, British and American material to deal with. And secondly, if you go for a second language, you maybe go for German. And then maybe you go for French if you can do it. And then maybe you kind of go for Russian or Italian. So for an English speaker, an English native speaker, scholar, Italian will never be a priority unless you are an Italianist, because your assessment is, rightly so, that other countries played greater roles in those conflicts. So you first go for the other languages, but then you still write about Italy, and that's the vicious circle. Whereas for the Italians, English should have been the priority as a foreign language. So I think the responsibility has to be put on both sides.
How would you characterize relations between the two powers in the period running from 1860 to 1900?
You mean Britain and Italy?
Yes.
Yes. So that's quite interesting because from the Italian perspective, there was an extraordinary relationship. It was a fantastic relationship. They saw the British as the main supporter of the process of Italian reunification. Italy got unified in 1861. And did so thanks to British diplomatic backing and also financial support, not only in the sense that the British government gave financial aid to the government Sardinia, Piedmont, which was the kingdom that unified Italy, but in the sense that many British donors played a major role in supplying Italian patriots and the Italian unification movement, or movements, plural, with the financial aid. And also the Italians had a cultural linkage with the British, whom they saw as the modern version of the Roman Empire. And the British saw themselves in, you know, under the same light. So this historical aspect was important. The cultural aspect was also important. And then there was a geopolitical aspect, which from the Italian side played an important role. You know, Britain was the only country with which Italy had never clashed, because one may say France played a major role in the Second War of Independence, the Second Italian War of Independence in 1859, true, but then Italy fell out with France when Napoleon III, who was leading that campaign, refused to continue the war and signed an armistice with the Austrians. And the war ended up with without the annexation of Venice to Italy. Then, in order to get Venice, the Italians allied themselves with the Prussians, who were also trying to unify the German states in Central Europe. And that alliance did, in fact, bring about the annexation of Venice, but did not deliver a final blow to the Austrians, who remained a traditional enemy of Italy. And actually, Berlin and Vienna became allies. And so the relationship with the Germans and the Austrians remained ambivalent on the Italian side. Competition with France remained very high, and competition with Russia increased over the years, both in the Balkans and in the Eastern Mediterranean. And now who was left? Britain. So, you know, Britain was the main commercial partner and the geopolitical actor, which Italy saw as closer to itself, especially because the Italian colonial ambitions had not manifested themselves to the level, to the degree that would, in fact, be seen as a threat by the British, which happened throughout the First World War. But up until that moment, Britain and Italy were actually very good friends. Now, the interesting thing is that whereas the Italians thought this to be the basis for a very good, you know, and lasting alliance, you know, a formal alliance, and tried several times to, you know, to bring that about, the British didn't quite share that view. I mean, they were very happy to have the Italians on their side in the sense that they considered Italy an important, you know, geostrategic player in the center of the Mediterranean. They, of course, were happy to have commercial ties with Italy. But first of all, they didn't feel, as the Italians felt, that they needed Italy militarily. And secondly, they thought that a formal alliance with the Italians might cause the British some troubles, because if the Italians ended up in a war against Austria or France or both or any other great power, the British were almost certain that the Italians would, you know, appeal for help. And the British didn't want to get involved into any of this until the outbreak of the First World War. So we have an asymmetrical alliance here. Sorry, asymmetrical relationship here. The Italians wanted an alliance. The British were not quite happy, and so they remained friends but not allies.
Did not the Franco-Italian rapprochement at the beginning of the 20th century make one between Britain and Italy inevitable?
Some said so at Whitehall. Some considered, in fact, the rapprochement of the French and the Italians as a good thing that brought Italy closer to the Entente, especially as Italy was constantly having troubles with its Austrian allies, because, of course, by that moment, Italy was formally in an alliance with Central Powers. So upon German invitation, was a member of the Triple Alliance, so Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy, in fact. But the very reason that Italy was part of the opposing bloc also caused some trouble, some problems, some doubts, some reservations in London, because attracting Italy too blatantly on the French and British side might have spurred a German reaction. So it was certainly the fact that the French and the Italians were not in a stronger, colliding course was good news for the British. But again, that was not sufficient for them to work actively to produce a proper formal shift in alliances until the war came.
Who were Sir Rennell Rodd and Marchese Imperiale, and why were they important in Anglo-Italian relations in this period?
Yeah, well, the first one you mentioned, Rodd, was the British ambassador in Rome, and Imperiale was the Italian ambassador in London. And the reason why they are very important is that they were at the front, at the forefront of all the negotiations and the talks and the discussions about first the manage well, of course, the management of Anglo-Italian relations, but more importantly, as the war approached, first they were the protagonists of all the secret talks that brought Italy into the Entente, and secondly, they were the protagonists of all the negotiations that occurred during the war. So they participated and tried to shape the politics of their respective governments and tried to bridge differences and explain, you know, the situation during the 1916. Talks and particularly the 1917 talks that would lead to the Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne Treaty of April 1917. And the reason why they played an important role was not merely that they were, of course, the ambassadors, but that they were a pro-Italian British ambassador and a pro-British Italian Britain-Italian ambassador. So they had a very special relationship with at least part of the leading class of the country where they were hosted. And so they were in a special position to influence as much as they could the behavior of the respective foreign ministries.
Why did Sir Edward Grey, British Foreign Secretary, reject Rodd's urging that Grey work on Italy's joining the Entente in 1911-1912?
Yeah, essentially for the reason that I mentioned earlier on. Grey was, of course, interested in maintaining strong relations with the Italians. It was also considered pro-Italian by some Italian diplomats. I find that statement a bit exaggerated, but certainly was a man who saw Italy in a different light compared to Salisbury or other British statesmen who had essentially regarded Italy as, yes, an interesting partner, a commercial partner, but nothing really more than that. By 1911, when Italy invaded modern-day Libya and took it, you know, at that point, Italy became a significant factor in the central Mediterranean. The new Italian colony bordered onto Egypt. So for the British, that was, you know, an entirely different geostrategic situation. And in fact, Grey protested vehemently when the Italians attacked the Ottoman Empire. But nonetheless, he wanted to keep a good rapport with them. But again, because of the complicated network of, understandings that were in place between Italy and France, and France and Great Britain, and the British also didn't want to, you know, to fall out with the Ottomans too much either. And also there was always the same problem, you know, the Germans. What would the Germans say? What would they do if we kind of break their alliance by attracting one of the members, the only Mediterranean member that they actually had, into our orbit? Now, Rodd was making this suggestion because by that moment, you know, there was already a kind of a cold war between Germany and Great Britain, and the German naval rearmament was probably the thing that alarmed the British the most. And how do you reduce that danger? If you can attract their only Mediterranean partner into our orbit and make it our ally, there's no way they can match us at sea, even if they pursue their naval rearmament. And that was the rationale of Rodd. But again, I think Grey was right in rejecting that suggestion, because such a massive intrusion into the other bloc was almost was going to be received, almost certainly going to be received very, very badly by the Germans.
On page 42, you state, quote, Italy really belonged to the bloc of the Western powers, unquote. Did that so-called bloc include Tsarist Russia?
No, not necessarily. In fact, I didn't say the Entente, I said the Western powers. And that was a question of, you know, the liberal institutions that Italy had, which were extremely similar to those of Great Britain, and the cultural tradition that, of course, linked Italy with France. Now, the role of Russia is interesting, however, because with the Russians, the Italians had signed a secret treaty at the Racconigi, which essentially stated that if the Austrians expanded further into the Balkans, we should remember that in 1909, the Austrians had annexed Bosnia without giving Italy any compensation for that, as was, you know, theoretically part of the Triple Alliance Treaty. The Austrians refused to do that, and the Italians then made this agreement with the Russians that any further move of the Austrians in the Balkans would have been deterred by the Italians and the Russians together. So you see already here, although Italy was again was part of the bloc of the Central Powers, but it was establishing some separate unilateral and secret understandings with both France, as we mentioned, and now Russia. And of course, so London as, you know, the best friend, if you want to put it that way. So you really see Italy kind of slowly moving away from the German bloc, primarily because of the old enmity with the traditional, you know, enemy of Italy, which was seen, you know, as Austria, of course.
Was the unprovoked Italian attack on the Ottoman Empire in 1911 an example of Italian commitment to, quote, international law, unquote?
Can you repeat the quote?
Was the unprovoked attack on the Ottoman Empire in 1911 by Italy an example of what you refer to as Italian commitment to international law?
Well, their attack was unjustified in the sense that the Ottomans didn't attack first, didn't do anything to, you know, to provoke the Italians, and that's actually a sign of how the Italian foreign policy was changing in the years immediately leading to the First World War. They had been traditionally very careful at maintaining the European concert, as they called it, the European balance of power. And in fact, quite curiously, Imperiali, the same man who was by now the ambassador in London, had been an ambassador to Constantinople a few years earlier, and his task there was precisely to preserve the balance of power, maintain a good understanding with the Turks, and do everything that was possible to prevent any sort of crisis that might, you know, cause any troubles to that empire, which everyone was seeing already as an empire that was crumbling somehow. So up until that moment, yes, Italy had been very careful of maintaining the international order and respecting the international agreements and so on. But at the same time, there was a pressing environment on the Italian government to both avenge the humiliation suffered in Ethiopia when Italy was defeated in the colonial war in 1896, and also to find new land for Italian immigrants, and essentially, in fact, I think an argument might be made that the Italian attack on the Ottoman Empire was the real spark of the First World War, because it ignited a crisis that triggered the Balkan Wars, which of course had a consequence in the Sarajevo assassination and everything that followed. So by that point, so from that point of view, you're quite correct in underlining that Italy was not really anymore in line with the idea of a European concert.
You're right that Rome's declaration of neutrality on the 2nd of August 1914 quote, encourage London to issue its own ultimatum to Berlin over Belgium, unquote. Given the fact that the voluminous literature on the July crisis, this particular hypothesis is not mentioned once, what empirical evidence do you have that London was influenced in the way that you suggest?
Well, you know, Rod was, again, extremely active in promoting the idea that with Italy remaining neutral, the Germans could not win the war. And Barrère, who was the French ambassador to Rome, did the same thing in Paris. And he actually wrote in his memoirs that not Italian intervention, but the Italian declaration of neutrality allowed the French to transfer more than 300,000 men who were deployed along the Alps, so who were essentially guarding the southern borders north to engage the Germans on along the Marne River, which of course had a massive impact militarily on the failure of the Blitzkrieg, as it's so-called, you know, Blitzkrieg. So from Rome, you had both the French and the British diplomats and the British military mission as well, highlighting how important that was militarily, to the fact that Italy was not joining its formal allies, and diplomatically as well, you know, because this was also a question of legitimacy, the fact that one of the three allies did not share the perception of the Austrians and the Germans that they were fighting a defensive war and that they had been provoked and so on, was a diplomatic score for the Entente, even before Italy actively joined them in the war.
How important to Italian policy in this period was the succession of Sidney Sonnino from San Giuliano as foreign minister in the fall of 1914?
Right, that's an interesting question. So Sonnino was another character who has been portrayed pretty badly. He had a very bad press over the years. Richard Bosworth called him the worst ever Italian foreign minister. I partly agree, but partly disagree with that statement, in the sense that he made massive mistakes. He made huge mistakes, and anyone reading the book will find that out. But at the same time, quite interestingly, he was the only foreign minister in the countries that participated in the war in the early stages that remained in its post on its post for the duration of the war. So if you survive that long, you know, despite the stresses that the development of the war inevitably bring about onto both the political system and onto your personal reputation as a foreign minister, if you survive that long, you can't really be the worst ever. You can't be so bad. And this brings me to answer your question more directly. So why was it important? Because by getting Sonnino as a foreign minister, the Italians found someone who was extremely determined, extremely strong as a political figure, and who was capable of giving the Italian foreign policy, which was traditionally fluctuating, a single, unique, clear direction. And in fact, interestingly enough, although he was not appreciated either in Paris or in London, but when it came to changing the Italian ministries, when the Italians changed their war cabinets, which happened three times during the war, any time the British made it clear that they wished Sonnino to stay, because Sonnino was a guarantee of a clear direction in Italian foreign policy, which meant at that point that the Italians remained in the Entente. From that point of view, it was important. From another point of view, from the point of view of Sonnino's personal achievement, it was a double-edged sword. But in terms of, you know, theoretical achievements on paper, he got something very substantial in 1917. Now, he didn't manage to get what he was promised in Paris. But in 1917, if you look at the results of the colonial talks, his achievement is actually quite remarkable.
What for you were the, or what was the key variable as to why Italy joined the Entente side in the war in the spring of 1915?
Well, that has to be understood in a variety of ways. There are several factors. Of course, you know, the traditional enmity with Austria, which I have already mentioned. You know, the desire to acquire those territories which were inhabited primarily by Italians, but were still under Austrian control. A sheer desire of, you know, imperial expansion, which has not always been appreciated by Italian historians. But I think which is why I called the book Empires, you know, Forging Empires. Italy was in fact trying to forge its own empire in emulation of, you know, ancient Rome, of course, and so that also played an important part. And then, as I said, it was essentially a decision motivated by two considerations. So who's your best friend and who's your worst enemy? and Italy had two good friends, London and Berlin. And two kind of enemies, you know, Paris and Vienna. So at the end of the day, what turned out to be the final decision was that London was more important as a friend than Berlin, and France was less traditional, less of an enemy than Vienna. But again, because it came to that point, I go back to my previous point that Italy inevitably would have to join the war at some point. Of course, you know, the principle of inevitability, or the concept of inevitability, when applied to history, it's of course, you know, it's questionable. But I think a case can be made that it was almost, let's put it that way, it was almost inevitable that Italy would join one side or the other for economic reasons. Because Italy, by that point, was suffering from a double blockade. It was suffering from the blockade of Gibraltar, so a British blockade in the Western Mediterranean, and from the blockade of the Straits in the East by the Turks. And that problem affected hugely the Italian economy, because through the Straits, Italy would get grain supplies. And through the Western Mediterranean, it would get raw materials and wheat and so on. So Italy could simply not afford to stay neutral if that meant the impossibility to trade with both coalitions. And in that regard, the British blackmail proved very successful. The economic warfare that indirectly Britain was using as a diplomatic tool to force the hand of the neutral countries, not just Italy, but also Spain and Portugal, was very important, because the Turks closed the Dardanelles, and of course Italy needed to either, you know, have access to that area of Europe, or to the Western one. And of course, you know, the connection, the commercial connections with Western Europe was both more important and the fact that the British were not happy to indulge on that regard was actually an important stimulus. The Italians simply had to choose where they wanted to trade, but they simply could not remain without the possibility to trade with both coalitions, and that is evidenced by a significant economic crisis that hit the country in the winter of 1415. There were riots, there were protests in the streets, there were fights between the carabinieri, so the gendarmerie, and the peasantry. So the situation was getting, you know, very serious, and so I think this aspect, the economic warfare, was important and has been traditionally little appreciated. And finally, you know, the other fascinating point is that Italy was essentially turned into a battlefield of espionage and propaganda between pro-Entente agents and pro-Germany agents and so on. So all, you know, all these elements, of course, played a role.
Would you agree with Dennis Mack Smith, among others, that the anti-democratic means by which Italy entered the Great War in the spring of 1915 was a forerunner of Mussolini's seizure of power in 1922?
Yes. That, you know, put it that way, it's maybe a bit extreme because, again, it's about inevitabilities. But certainly, the fact that the interventionist wing was spearheaded by mad dogs who used daggers to terrify all the enemies of the intervention. And actually, you know, the squads that would take power in Rome in 1922 began to go around, to form, to be established, and to be active in Italian politics in 1915. So in that regard, I do agree. Some Italian authors actually called that period a low-intensity civil war. Now, again, that's a bit extreme, but that gives you the idea of how extreme the confrontation in Italian squares and in Italian politics was becoming by then, yes.
Why did Italy wait until 1916 to declare war on Germany?
Because it was not prepared. Italy was an aspiring great power, but was not yet a great power. And for engaging in a world war of the kind, you know, that the French and the British were, you know, engaged into, for doing that, Italy needed a much stronger mobilization. Italy had joined the war on the premises that, you know, the big slogan was Trento and Trieste. So let's take back those Italian cities in the hands of the Austrians. And in that regard, Italy saw its participation in the First World War kind of as a personal affair with Austria. You know, it was the final confrontation with the traditional enemy. Now, Germany was much more important and influential in Italy because, you know, Prussia and Italy had been allied previously, and because Germany had acquired many newspapers, banks, companies. There was a huge level of investment, not as huge as the British one, but still Germany was part number two. And so there were sectors of the Italian business, parts of the Italian business sector, which were pressing the government not to break entirely with the Germans. And then, as I said, it was a question of, you know, preparedness. So the Italian army had not fortified the border with Switzerland, which was a neutral country, and felt that before declaring war to Germany, which had showed that he was very well prepared to invade neutral countries, they needed to fortify that border. And in the meantime, they hoped that that they could get to Vienna. You know, this was conceived as almost a triumphant march onto Vienna. So they thought that if we break the Austrians soon enough, we don't even need to get to war with the Germans. And in that regard, why should we disperse our forces to fortify the Swiss border if we can concentrate them on, in the east and get to Vienna? You know, so in that sense, when they realized that they would not get to Vienna anytime soon, at that point, they decided that, and of course the British were in the forefront of a diplomatic battle on this. But at that point, they realized that, we are in a world war. We need to take part, you know, as a full member of the alliance, especially because otherwise, if we don't do it, they might not give us everything that they had promised on the end of the war.
How, if at all, did Italy coordinate or not its military efforts with the other Entente powers?
That's a chiaroscuro, you know, that's a mixed story. And the interesting part of it is that on paper, everyone repeated that better coordination was badly needed. Cadorna, the Italian chief of staff, repeated that. Joffre, so the French chief of staff, said pretty much the same thing. Haig said the same thing. Robertson as well. You know, everyone was repeating that. Lloyd George, particularly when he came to power, was extremely determined to bring that about. But then when it came to we coordinated to do what, the individual differing priorities of the entente countries that resurfaced, and especially the fact that the French and the British had Germany as their main enemy, as their main opponent, and as I said, Italy declared war on Germany because it was in the Entente, but had Austria-Hungary as its main enemy. So the Italians, when they called for better coordination, it was essentially, you know, let's put pressure onto Serbia to do more, let's break Austria, and so on. Let's, you know, cooperate in the Mediterranean. And of course, when the French and the British spoke about coordination, they were like, okay, you join us in the war on Germany and we break Germany first, because we break, you know, the Napoleonic methods of breaking the principal mass of the enemy, you know. And then there was also something more prickly here, because although, again, on paper, everyone was looking for better coordination, then, you know, Cadorna was not entirely happy. Well, Sonnino certainly was not happy to have a massive support by the Allies, because, you know, diplomatically and politically, having such a big support on your own front, it was not something that you want to sell to either your public or, in fact, your allies, because they will always tell you, okay, you didn't win because you won, but you won because we came and we did, you know, our part. So there was also, you know, these calls for coordination were kind of always half-hearted in that sense.
How did the British react to Italian efforts to revive the Sykes-Picot Treaty?
Again, it's a mixed story. In part, they were very worried about the increased nature of the Italian claims, the increased amount of colonial demands. On the other hand, the fact that the Sykes-Picot Treaty might be revised was interesting for them, because by the time these discussions were taking place, which is 1917, the British had made significant advances in the colonial theater, especially into Palestine, and were approaching Syria. We're just about to get into Syria. And, of course, the French wanted Syria. And at the same time, as these advances took place, an environment was being established in London, where you know, some imperialists that joined Lloyd George in the war cabinet were not quite happy to restore the territories that Britain was conquering during the war, as opposed to Grey's and Asquith's assumption that anything that was that Britain was taking would be restored, because, you know, the British were uninterested in expanding their empire further and wanted simply, you know, to restore the balance of power in Europe. By the time Lloyd George came to power, that idea was kind of crumbling, and it was put aside pretty soon. And because the British were expanding their own ambitions, the fact that they could revise the Sykes-Picot agreement with the French and reduce French claims because of that was a very interesting perspective. That played out partially because, of course, the French vetoed any significant revision. But nonetheless, they brought the Italians into the picture, and, well, they allowed the Italians into the picture, and that per se counterbalanced the French in Anatolia, for example.
How did the debacle at Caporetto in October 1917 impact on Anglo-Italian relations?
Yeah, that's another interesting question. It impacted very much for a number of reasons. Number one, the British had so far concentrated on trying to expand the Italian participation in the war. As you mentioned very correctly, Italy did not join the Allies in the war on Germany until the summer of 1916, when they achieved a significant victory against the Austrians and felt strong enough to do that. So the British had been pressing the Italians and also blackmailing the Italians with, putting, financial support on ice, for a year. So until Caporetto, the problem for the British was to really have the Italians as a more active and efficient participant in the war. After Caporetto, the problem was to keep Italy in the war. So the priority changed dramatically, and again the British were probably the main supporter of an Italian recovery, both economically and also militarily. They were important. And at the same time, Caporetto gave the British an awareness of how the Italians needed help, and so how the Italian posture as Italy's posture as a great power was kind of not really a truth. Kind of a diplomatic stance more than anything else, more than a reflection of a military strength. But at the same time, it also gave the British the perfect excuse to gain some control over their Italian allies, because Italy had been, as I said, very reluctant to join the British in a number of instances, a number of things and matters. And so now, because the relevance of Italy in the Entente and also their sheer need for help put Italy in a much vulnerable position. The British were once the emergency was over, so it was clear that Italy was not going to defect. Okay, at that point, the British exploited the fact that the Italians were politically much weaker now, and that helped them establish, the Supreme War Council and unify Allied strategy much better than hitherto.
Why do you claim that the victory at Vittorio Veneto was mostly an Italian as opposed to a British or Allied victory?
Well, it's a matter of, it's a pure matter of numbers. By the time in late 1918 when the offensive started, by that time, the troops, the Allied troops, so the British, American, and French troops in Italy, were very weak. They're just a few divisions and only one regiment of the Americans. So that offensive saw some 50 Italian divisions against five of the Czechoslovakians, the British and the French, plus again an American regiment. So in terms of numbers, it was like almost entirely the Italians who fought the battle. Now, the importance of the Allies in that battle was not so much that they participated with their troops, but that they had helped the Italian army recover. They had resupplied the Italian army. They had supported the Italian industrial reconstruction of the war machine, and they had also helped in restoring morale. So those are important, significant contributions. But one cannot say that it was a British victory because they had a couple of divisions,
How did Anglo-Italian relations evolve in the period after the armistice in November 1918?
Yeah, that was really the climax of their bilateral relationship. Because, and again, interestingly, there is a major misunderstanding here between the Italians and the British, because the Italians kept thinking and counting. They kept thinking that the British were actually their main partner, and they kept counting on them to counterbalance both the revisionist ideas of President Wilson, so of the Americans, and the French, who were, of course, the old competitor of the Italians in the Western Mediterranean and North Africa by this point, with Tunisia bordering on Libya. And they kept counting on that remarkably, despite the fact that even before the Paris Peace Conference, the British had made it very clear that they considered all the colonial treaties so far signed to be lapsed. And again, this is, maybe the Italians has always been considered, Machiavellian, so very, cynic and determined in getting what they wanted and so on, very stubborn and so on. I kind of doubt it. I mean, I found the behavior of the Italian statesmen at the conference to be extremely naive. They weren't able to revise their own expectations. They weren't able to read developments and in events, you know, with the necessary detachment to actually grasp what was going on behind the scenes. They weren't able to change paradigm. They weren't able to build up alternative partnerships with other members of the LA. They kept counting that London would not just mediate between the allies, but actively support Italian claims, although by that point, as I said, the colonial claims of Italy had expanded significantly to the point of threatening British primacy and interests both in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. So in that regard, the British, you know, were super happy that that the Americans were vetoing most of the Italian demands because that put the British in a perfect position. They asked, sorry guys, it's not our fault. Yes, we would give you everything that has been promised, but you know, it's not us, it's the Americans. And on the other hand, the Italians were completely unable to grasp this.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Maybe a couple of things, very, very briefly. One is that we need more and more comparative history. We need to address, I can't stress more how important it is to address sources in the original language. A suggestion I might make is that if you want to write about Italy, learn Italian. You know, it's not an easy language, but it's not an extremely complicated one either. And so it's a nice language to learn. But of course, the same point could be made about Russian or Turkish, you know, all those languages that are important if you really want to grasp what was going on in those countries, even if you write about them from a Western perspective. You know, we have Western historians and scholars writing about Russia or Turkey, the Ottoman Empire in the First World War. I'm not sure how many documents they were actually able to, you know, grasp, or even secondary literature. You know, so learning languages is very important. Unfortunately, now we have a new generation of historians that are much more keen on that. A second point is about strategy and the reality gap, I think, you know, because there is a tendency to see some combatants in the First World War as being fairly good operationally, but inconsistent strategically. The Germans are an obvious case in point here. But sometimes it was the other way around, and the Allies are a case in point here. You know, even when they got a strategy correct, broadly speaking, they continued to face insurmountable odds at the operational and tactical levels. And now you might say that this is an indication that the strategy itself was not sufficiently conceptualized or thought through, but in some cases it's also it is also a consequence of, you know, of the fog of war, the impact of the unpredictable. You know, no matter how good planning you make, even assuming that you have all the good intelligence, that you calculate and you include everything, all the variables in your plan, so you do a very good planning, and then still, you know, the things develop differently. And sometimes there is nobody to really to blame for that. You know, in the Mediterranean, the British tended to shoulder responsibility for the frustrating development in the naval war onto the Italians, and vice versa, the Italians blamed the British. But in fact, you know, sometimes it's not that. It's a matter of sheer luck or bad luck. So that's philosophically, if you will, it's probably the most important lesson that the study of military history teaches us. You know, not everything is under our control.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Dr. Marcuzzi, for being so kind to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you once again, Dr. Marcuzzi.
Thanks.